Yeah, no, that's fun. I do like to go and visit little places when I can. I've been kind of trying to visit a bunch of not just burial sites, but finds and there's so many cross stone, you know, like cross shafts and
the hogback stones. And
yeah, so I went to see the hogbacks, and there's a bunch of just in general, just I think there's a ton of cross shafts and some like entire crosses that are still, there's like a bunch in and around Yorkshire. And I went up to see the Loki stone.
I actually can't say familiar with that.
The Loki, it's the Loki or bound devil stone. It's up on the border of Cumbria. And I think it could be Loki, but they don't know if it really is. But it's from, I think, the 9th century. It's early. But they're not kind of sure what it is. But it does look like like a devil bound.
Which yeah, could be, yeah. I just googled it.
But I had a girl on here who specializes in all Loki saga material. And she was saying that there's very little to even suggest people knew of Loki during the Viking Age. She was like, there's hardly anything at all. Well, oh, nothing. There's like these two stones. I think there's that one and one in... it's gone out of the head, top of my head. The island in Sweden where everything
Gotland.
Is found. Gotland, yeah. So I think there's one there that might have Loki on. But other than that, there's no like place names. There's pretty much nothing. She was like, yeah, maybe he didn't exist. Which I love stuff like that.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, I was a bit, when Bob asked me if I wanted to be on the Nordic Mythology podcast, I was a bit like, I mean, I don't do any kind of Nordic mythology stuff, mostly because it's like so outside the bounds of what I do as an archaeologist and historian, mm-hmm. you know, and because it is, it's just, there's not a lot of like contemporary 9th, 10th century evidence for any sort of, you know, for the mythology. Not mm-hmm. a lot. There's some, but not a lot. So why was it? But he did say you guys had like expanded out a little bit. So
yeah, we do bits. The name happened right at the start. But saying that, even when we first started, I don't think we did. I think the first episode we ever did was on Shield Maidens, and then we did Symbols. So we've kind of, it's never really been, I don't even know where the name came from. We just needed a name.
Yeah.
I think Mateus had a channel called the Nordic Mythology Channel or something. And we were just like, let's just add podcast to the end.
Perfect.
It'll work. So yeah, that's where it came. And we haven't stuck to mythology. And that's the fun part, that it's kind of everything all together. And you get to speak to people like you, I guess, are more fact-based and what we have and not as. And then whereas last week I spoke to a gentleman who does a lot of cooking and tries to recreate things from recreate like recipes from old material, not necessarily from the Vikings. He says there's not much, but maybe after all, look at like what ingredients they would have had. So it's very much kind of experimental archaeology. And I enjoy that just as much as anything else. It's kind of this whole mix of everything together. I think that's how you get closer to the truth than just one.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I was, I was doing a dig in Lancaster, and we went out to Heysham and Morecambe Bay, and we met someone when we were looking at a hogback stone at the Heysham church.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that there's one there.
But we were talking to someone, and he was saying that they, like, his grandmother made nettle beer that grandmother was convinced was passed down from the Viking Age. Like, you know, we were a bit like, okay, but like at the same time too, like the idea that tradition has remained, and the idea that like there's that cultural awareness, it was cozy. It was definitely very nice.
And I guess it's so easy to roll your eyes at Still, because anybody who hangs out on Facebook any length of time amongst anything to do with the Vikings, you tend to get people who are like, oh, I'm descended from Ragnar, or I'm descended from Odin. And they're like adamant that they can prove that, or even people like, I'm descended from a Harald Finer, I can prove it. And it's like, no, you fucking can't. Like, well, stop it.
Actually, the way that genetics works, anyone with European ancestry genetically has been descended from Charlemagne. That's okay. A fact.
Oh,
that's
really?
That's just the way that genetics works. Like, by the time that you go up to your great-great-grandparents, you have 32 great-great-grandparents.
Okay.
And so as you splinter out, everyone with European ancestry descended from Charlemagne.
I feel like that's a cop-out. I'm not going to lie. I feel like that. I feel
but
like
it's true.
I believe it is true, but I feel like that's not the point they're trying to make. They're trying to make how they can pinpoint the line all the way back.
Oh, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Like, I'm just saying that you can then turn around and be like, yeah, so am I.
Oh, okay. I don't really care. But it was more to the point of you get these stories of like these things passed down, and you hear that about the nettle beer, and it's like, oh, yeah, whatever. But maybe, you know, things have survived through oral traditions and for much longer. So there's no reason why it's not.
Exactly. Yeah. Like I said, it's cozy. It's cozy.
Skeptic in me always is like, yeah, whatever.
I think nettle beer is a little bit less ideological than descended from Ragnar.
Yeah. Because Ragnar's always one. And I would love to know how many people descended from Ragnar had the TV show not focused around Ragnar.
Don't get me started on the TV show.
Because I guarantee it would be not as many.
Yeah.
Nowhere near.
Yeah.
I probably should do an intro because I'm going to keep this starting. So, okay. I'm just good. It's Tanaya Jorgensen. There we go. I'm this is all staying in, so people are going to hear me checking your name as well. So it is what
it is. It's a mouthful, yes. Tanaya Jorgensen.
All right. Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I guess the intro is a little bit late, but I'm sat down with Tanaya Jorgensen, which you heard because I just had to check how to pronounce it. And we're going to talk about mapping the Viking Age. You've made this beautiful, you said 3,000 point map.
Roughly.
Trying to add some chronological order to the Viking Age. Am I right in that?
Yeah. I mean, I guess, like what we talked a little bit beforehand, like I'm not a gatekeeper to the idea of knowledge, especially because the Viking Age and Viking history is so fraught right now in the context of the adoption of the far right. And so I'm just trying to take a little bit of the mystery and maybe a little bit of, as I said before, the ideology out of the Viking Age and just presenting a really useful tool for both the general public and teachers and students to explore the Viking Age using both historical sources, what we have from that period, and also archaeological material, including graves and female jewelry, specifically in Britain only, and coin hoards. So yeah, I'm an archaeologist by trade. I did my PhD in history and archaeology I did my PhD in history, but incorporated archaeology into my research. And so, yeah, I have taken a fact base, but I'm also a highly visual learner. I've tried to create something fun for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you kindly earlier said, and I quote, I don't give a fuck. I'll share the link, which I think is brilliant that you're happy to kind of put it out there and let people look at it and learn from it. And then, like you say, there's no gatekeeping around your work. You're happy to let people enjoy it. And like I said, learn and use it. And hopefully, like you say, take some of that ideology out of it. And we can just disprove a few of those assholes on that side. It would be good.
Yes, that would be super nice if we could do that.
So we will put the link in the show notes for anybody that's listening. You can just pop down. And when I say show notes, I don't know if everyone always knows what that is. It's like the little bit of text beneath the podcast, wherever you download it, there's like a little description in there. We'll hit the link and you can check it out, because there are a bunch of places on there. I'm certainly going to have a closer look at it and see what I can go and visit.
Yes. So it's basically, it focuses on Ireland, Britain, and France and Germany. A little bit of Spain as well. So it doesn't focus on Scandinavia itself. And mostly that has to do with the fact that there are no contemporary sources for the Vikings at the Viking Age in Scandinavia itself. So all that we have from that period, and by contemporary, I do mean that like written at the time that those things were happening. Mm-hmm. And so, so the Vikings themselves, we have, rune stones, but even then the rune stones tend to be a little bit later, like 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th century. Mm-hmm. And they don't really communicate action or chronological happening in the way that continental British, Irish chronicles were taking mm-hmm. notes. So,
yeah, I assume we're talking about Vikings in the literal sense of people who go in raiding. So I guess that would be why you wouldn't see so much within Scandinavia itself.
Well, there's just nothing being written there. Nothing's being written until the arrival of Christianity.
But that got me thinking, okay, maybe you know the answer to this or not. This is how the show works, by the way. Things just pop up into my head and then I just ask them.
Go nuts.
Did people in Scandinavia in the Viking Age go a Viking within Scandinavia? Do we have?
Yes.
So that was, it just got me thinking, because I always thought like externally, and then a little light bulb moment happened. I was like, yeah, but why wouldn't they? Why wouldn't they go and?
Well, yeah. You know, they absolutely did.
Those over there.
They absolutely did. I think like you can argue that the Scandinavians, the Norwegians, Swedes, you know, there was a shift already between the Finns in the far north, who are the Sapmi today, the Sami. They were very distinct culturally from European Scandinavian, I suppose, which were kind of Othere's voyage, which was recorded in the court of Alfred the Great. He had a Norwegian merchant come to his court who told his story. It was written down in his court in Old English, and it records how he went raiding north of his home in Trondelag at Trondheim, and raided against the Finns. And I think there is also in the Frankish annals, the Danish king sends an envoy to the court of the Franks saying, okay, there were some Danish raids, there were some pirate raids going on in your coast, but they were not my military, and I've captured these Danish pirates and I have killed them. Mm-hmm. And then he asked for a reward mm-hmm. from the Franks. So
I mean, that feels like, I don't know if business model is the right the right way to put it, but waiting for somebody to go to Britain and do their raiding, get all the booty and put it on the ship and bring it back. Feels like it's quite a good idea just to, instead of going all the way to Britain, just go there and steal it from them instead. Just be like, because I imagine if they suffered loss, the army wouldn't be as strong. So it would, even if they won, it would maybe still be depleted. Maybe you could just go and be like, I'm going to come over there.
Depends on what you're looking for. I think Scandinavia at that time was not very rich in silver and gold. So, I mean, even like Gotland, covered in silver Durham hoards, right? Covered in silver Durham hoards. There's not a lot of silver Durham hoards into Scandinavia.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're looking for mineral wealth, if you're looking for metals, you've got to leave Scandinavia to do that.
No, but I mean, if you knew... Let's say you were a chieftain in Denmark, and then you knew, or even within Norway itself, like you were just a chieftain in Norway, and you knew like 100 miles north there was another chieftain who was sending a raiding party to England. I feel like just wait for them to come back with all the gold and silver and then just nip up there. And certainly if it was before there was like a united king who could maybe then punish you, maybe if it was like when it was like every man for themselves, you could just kind of nip up and be like, hey, I want that now.
I think that likely happened. We just don't have the records for it.
Mm.
And there is a theory that has been presented, and I actually build on it in my thesis, that the reason that the raiding started is because there was centralization of power, like especially along the western coast of Norway, where you had all these tribes and these smaller kings, these smaller chieftains were being pushed out by a centralizing power that was growing to claim kingship. And that's why the raid started to begin with, because they were losing their, you know, if we want to use a Game of Thrones term, they were forced to bend the knee. So they were losing their kind of lands or material wealth and sought it out in a different country, different place.
Okay. So I see. I thought you were going to say that it's like a united, like, I don't know if United Kingdom's the right word, but like a united force would then allow the resources to be able to go further afield, whereas maybe individually they wouldn't have had the manpower maybe to, because I imagine I've always wondered this, I guess, and we're going quite far off topic, but I've always wondered how, you know, if you're taking a ship of 30 men, I just feel like that's very brave to land on land you don't know and be like, and just go and steal things and think that you're going to get away okay. I feel like...
I mean, I wouldn't do it.
Yeah, so I feel like I would want... There's more power in numbers, I guess.
I mean, I think it's that cost versus reward analysis going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It had to be worth it.
Yeah, I mean, it has to be terrifying to just be, I don't know this land, and we've, because it's not like a full army. You can't take, obviously in some extreme cases, like the
but
great
they started by raiding the monasteries, mm-hmm. right? Like that was their target. Like they went to Iona, they went to Lindisfarne, they went to Jarrow, they went to the island of Inishbofin on the west coast of Ireland. Like they raided monasteries. Like no one there had weapons. They were like, and not only were they taking silver, and I was just on an archaeological excavation here in Norway at a place called Sem, and it's very close to where they found the Hohenhorde. So if anyone's interested in metal, check out the Hohenhorde in Norway. It's fantastic. It's gorgeous. So we were 2 kilometers away from there, and a metal detectorist had found a part of an Irish reliquary box, which was so cool. Mm-hmm. And so we know that some Irish Viking Age shit had come over from and landed over there, as well as the Hohenhorde. And so, yeah, the big thing is that all these they're raiding monasteries, not only for silver, for gold, for books, for things that are valuable, but they're also taking slaves. Mm-hmm. Probably not a lot to begin with, but you know, one or two, taking them home, putting them on the farm, making them do work. Yeah. Like cost versus reward, I think the reward was very high.
Yeah, I always find it quite funny how they seem to be this very like, I think like a misconception of how like people in the Viking Age were almost better than now. Like you always hear this thing of like, oh, it was very equal between men and women. That's always one that you hear all the like, you may, maybe not within like the scholarly world, but you out, like I'm obviously like outside of that, and you hear this all the time about how things were like perfectly equal, and it was almost utopian. But people forget that they took slaves. And I'm not in any defense of slavery, but you can clearly understand why. Well, you can understand why they would do that, because it's like, okay, we're gonna come to this place where there's these people, we can take them back and make them do the manual labor that I really don't want to do because it stinks. And I can spend my time doing things that I want to do. And that I'm not advocating this is the right thing to do, but I'm saying in a time 1,000 years ago, you can see why it was an option when your only goal is to make your life easier and to make wealth. And you're not, I mean, they're either taking them as slaves or they're killing them. They're the two options.
But they weren't always killing them. I mean, they clearly left witnesses. But what I would say is that in this early medieval period, I mean, and you know, this is coming on the backs of the Roman period, and Roman was a slave empire. It was a slave empire. You know, human life was cheap, mm-hmm. and it did not contain, even within Christian nations at the time, it did not contain that same kind of Christian morality of souls and everyone, you know, is going to heaven. Like, it was very much like life was cheap, and you needed farm laborers, you needed house workers, you needed hands. And the idea of equality, like, it's very nice now, and I'm very happy to be living in the 21st century, but you know, we can't. Truly, the past is a different country. The past is a foreign country. Like, we cannot think about the Viking Age using our modern brains. It was a completely different culture, a completely different time. People died, people lived in vastly different ways. Like, death for us now is so sterilized. You know, like, when was the last time you saw somebody die? It's a very infrequent occurrence. God bless. Like, I mean, not God bless, but anyway, it's a very infrequent occurrence within Western society, thankfully. And, but it wasn't then, you know, everyone slept in the same room. So the act of sex was very much, it was public. It was, you know, childbirth was public, death was public. So it's a different world.
Yeah, it was just different. You can't look at it through the lens of today, I guess.
Exactly.
Which too many people do.
Yes.
I do find it very infuriating. Okay, so you mentioned two monasteries earlier, Iona and Lindisfarne. I mentioned before the podcast how it would be fun to look at the starting point of the Viking Age. Because obviously you've taken the time to map this out and use what you can to chronologically put some order to it. Now, obviously, to most people, Lindisfarne is the start of the Viking Age. It's the one that pops up if you type into Google, when did the Viking Age start? It's 793, am I right?
Yeah, 793.
Oh, fuck it. I've learned something during this podcast. I don't know where I pulled that one from. But yeah, so most people will say that's the start of the Viking Age, but obviously, like, with
it's
Iona,
not.
There we go. There's my little segue.
Yeah. No. So on my map, I have the timeline of the Viking Age. Viking activity begins in 777, and so the idea of Viking, I think, we kind of have to use that term just as like kind of a catch-all. Because my argument is that the Viking Age does not start with the raid on Lindisfarne. The Viking Age starts with politics. It starts with diplomacy. It starts with the encroachment of the Frankish kingdom up into the Danish lands. And you were talking about unification. I use the term centralization. Like, powers are centralizing around a king. Mm-hmm. So I truly believe that at the beginning of the Viking Age, in the late 700s, Denmark was a centralized kingdom. I call it the Danish kingdom, the Danish state. I don't call it Denmark because it doesn't reflect the later medieval Denmark. But at this time, I do think that there was a royal family ruling over a centralized Danish state, probably as a reaction, the strengthening as a reaction to the Franks. Gaining strength themselves, Charlemagne pushing northwards against the Saxons. The Saxons stood between the Danes and the Franks. And when Charlemagne conquered the Franks, you've got to imagine the Danes were like, fuck.
Yeah. So do you think that centralization is like a coming together as a, again, like we said earlier, like a united people against a common enemy?
I can't call it united. I can't call it united. Like I said, it's centralized. That okay. there was a king who ruled over a populated territory, who maybe did not get a bunch of chieftains to unite against the Franks, but certainly had created enough stability within their rule that they were able to send in 782, they were able to send Norse emissaries of King Sigrid, and this is in the Royal Frankish Annals, 782. King Sigrid sent emissaries down to Charlemagne's court and asked for peace. Okay. And that's 782. So 777, Wittekind Saxon escapes from an attack of the Franks over the Danish border and harbors with the Danish court. 782, King Sigrid of the Danes is sent emissaries down asking for peace. Charlemagne goes, cool, bro. And that to me is the beginning of the Viking Age, because what you have is this centralizing of Danish power, which probably includes the Oslo Fjord, southern Sweden, a loose confederation. I wouldn't call it a unionization, but a loose confederation, a power over these tribes, power over these earldoms. And then you have these ripplings of centralizing of power that head up along the western coast of Norway as well, where you see centralizing kings coming along there as well.
What do you think the reason is for them centralizing? Is it because they're looking south and are fearful, so they band together or in some way band together? Or is it that a single person is looking south and saying, I want to be like that, so I'm going to try and conquer? Does that make sense? Whether it's out of a centralizing because of a fear and then being able to protect themselves, or is it a single person or a single group of people going, oh, we're looking at Charlemagne and being, or anybody who's coming forward and saying, I want to have that power for myself just up here?
I cannot answer that question. I don't know. Okay. I think certainly later we do see Danes who align with like Louis the Pious trying to take over the kingdom of Denmark, fighting against their cousins or their nephews or whatever, who are trying to reflect, who are trying to create like a mini Frankish kingdom up in the north. But at this period, I think it's more reactionary, but we don't have any records internally. Mm-hmm. All we have are records from the Franks. So I cannot in good conscience, in conscience as a historian, archaeologist, make that claim.
People are so used to that answer on here, don't worry. That's okay. And to me, that's the correct answer, because it's the honest one. I'd be much more worried if you were like, oh yeah, absolutely, this is what it is. I'd be much more concerned. And it's probably a mixture of the two. It's probably a reactionary one, and then humans are humans. They're always going to exploit a situation. So if the situation arises out of fear and reacting, then there's always somebody's going to go, okay, now I can use this to snowball and gain my own
factions.
And their advantage from it. So, okay, because that's kind of got me confused in a sense of, oh, maybe you can answer whether it's even true, I guess. Because I have heard some controversy about it. This idea that Lindisfarne was a reaction to Charlemagne, did he decapitate shit ton of people, apparently, or something? Was it like 5,000 people?
782 at the Treaty of Battle of... I'm going to Google that. But it was 782, because that's the same year that Wittekind crosses the border into Denmark.
So I guess this is how I've heard it.
Okay.
This idea that Charlemagne, I think, beheaded it was 5,000 people, something like that.
Yep.
And then there was this reaction by Scandinavia to attack Lindisfarne because the Cuthbert because apparently Cuthbert was in some way involved with Charlemagne, and he left and went to Lindisfarne, which was his monastery, and then this attack from Scandinavia on Lindisfarne was like a reaction to that, to be like, fuck you, Charlemagne, we're going to attack Lindisfarne and take...
Oh, that's fascinating. Who said that?
I feel like it was Sturla Ellingvag, I think.
Okay.
Back along, this was one of the earlier...
Interesting theory.
I don't want to put... Also, I just have to say...
Yeah.
I'm not putting words in Sturla's mouth. He may have said it completely different to that. That's just my recapping of that conversation, and I'm just kind of seeing it spat around like different areas and me kind of putting it together. So I'm not putting words in his mouth. It's his explanation was probably way different because he's a scholar and I'm not. Yeah, that was like a very broad, quick kind of understanding of how I've heard it, and I'm sure people listening to this will have heard something similar.
I've never read that, like I've never seen that written down, and we talked about like we've talked about peer review and stuff, and why when I have my Viva, I do think it's very important to be challenged by experts. So I've never come across that written, peer reviewed, challenged by experts. I think it's a very interesting theory, but I don't think that we have any sort of proof to back that up.
Yeah, I think even when Sturla said it was very it was like a theory. He didn't put it forward as like fact. It was just an idea that it could have been. But I guess maybe it would be odd that it was 9 years later.
Yeah.
It would be.
But I think also the Saxons, like I said, they're this line between... The Saxons are this line between the Danes and the Franks. You know, they're very much where northern Germany is today.
Mm-hmm.
And the archaeological evidence that we have is that the raids that took place on Ireland and likely Lindisfarne and Iona, these first raids, likely took place from the west coast of Norway. So I also personally feel that raiding Lindisfarne when you could slip down into like the west coast of France would just, I don't know, like logically I don't know why you would cross the sea when it would be easier just to follow.
Mm-hmm. I feel like it's to do with what I read anyway. And this could be that somebody just made the connection after, was that it was to do with St. Cuthbert maybe being involved or around Charlemagne at the time, and then he's then resides in the monastery in Lindisfarne. But that also could just be people making a link after the fact and going, he was kind of there or thereabouts and now he's here. Maybe, and you know, it could be very, it could easily be that. It could, because I don't know how well informed the Norwegians would be of St. Cuthbert's whereabouts.
And also, the massacre of Verdun in 782 was done to the Saxons, and everything that I've come across is the Danes don't have a super strong... The Danes is definitely not... The Western Norwegians didn't really have a strong allyship with the Saxons.
Oh, maybe. I guess, again, it could just be a warning of like, don't come up here, we're gonna take your gold. Maybe, I don't know. Well, my idea.
Okay, anyway. I don't want to bash anyone.
No, don't. Yeah. No, be honest. You like saying
no? I disagree with this theory.
Yeah, well,
that's my honest opinion.
that's it. And I probably told it very terribly as well. But I've certainly heard that. That idea of like that being like a triggering point for the start of the Viking Age. But it, like I say, it could be this like romanticizing after the fact, because it's easy to make these links when you can sit back and look at like maybe like a map that you've created, and you can look at all the different points in the timelines and go, oh, well, clearly it's this, when in the time it's not.
Yeah.
That obvious.
I mean, I just don't even remember what I was doing 11 years ago. So,
yeah. So maybe, yeah. Oh, 11 years. I said 9 years earlier, didn't I? 11 years.
But yeah. It's 11.
I guess, because I think the other part of it was the purposeful. I think people made like a point of like the purposeful destroying of like Christian, rather than just taking things like the purposeful destroying, like, maybe sites like Paul Muhammad.
I don't think that they had it out for Christianity. I think that's such like a fucking like alt-right, like kind of runes, you know, like I think that's such a modern interpretation that the Vikings gave a shit about Christianity. I don't think they did. I think to them, they were just an opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I would agree. I think that it was, because it was this idea that they destroyed, like they would have gone out of their way to destroy crosses or deface things.
Yeah.
But then again, I just think you're in most cases, a bunch of guys who are running around stealing stuff and having a good time, I guess, to them. They're getting wealthy. They would be enjoying it. Somebody, and you're probably just going to destroy some stuff because guys are a bit dumb like that sometimes, and we just break shit when we get excited.
I mean, you said it, not me.
But it's true. Like, I've been around, especially for the drinking as well. I played in rugby teams. Like, I've been around guys when they're drinking. Sometimes they just break shit for no apparent reason because it might be funny. So I think that might happen. The similar thing could happen. It doesn't mean that they're then aiming to attack this thing because it's some symbolic fuck you to Christianity. And
yeah,
I think maybe people look into it a little too much. But there is this huge hatred for, or certainly now. Again, if you go online and on Facebook, like I do, because I'm an asshole and I can't help it, there is just anybody who's interested in this stuff, there's kind of like a, I would like to say like an entry level. Once people start to read more into it, they kind of become more educated and not as narrow, straight-minded with things.
Hopefully.
But certainly, like, people at the entry, they just have this such detest for Christianity because they're like, truly the Vikings must have hated Christianity, or like anybody who was pagan hated Christianity, so fuck you. And it's just like, I don't think it was that simple.
I mean, like, I'm an atheist today, and like, I don't hate Christianity. I don't, in the same way that I don't hate Muslims or Islam or Judaism. Like, it's just like, people have their own beliefs and like whatever, like and it's like we're still like we're humans today, we were humans 1,000 years ago, you know. I don't think it, especially in the North where they didn't have a practicing religion that was anything close to Christianity, no book, no, you know, probably personal rituals, probably larger rituals, whatever that was, however they practiced their faith. Like, I don't think it was this all-consuming hatred that like we like to envision. I think that that's a very easy narrative to write. And I think it was a narrative that was started by the Victorians, that it was like that these were like, oh, anti-Christian, the noble savage, you know. And it's just like, I think that that's simplifying something in a way that has already just been simplified, in the sense that they were just humans looking, you know, with different, again, the past is a foreign country and we can't look at Christianity and paganism through modern lenses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we have to remember that they weren't privy to the amount of knowledge that we are. Like,
no.
we live in a time where we know more than we ever have. You know, you can just search, Google something, you can pick up a book. There are tons of opportunities where you can learn about things. Whereas, you know, back 1,000 years ago, that wasn't the case. You couldn't just research something. It was
word of mouth. Yeah,
someone will have had to come and have told you. And then, I just feel like this whole, and people just fall into the trap of encompassing everybody in Scandinavia in the Viking Age into one boxing.
And let's not forget that, like, by the 850s, parts of Denmark and southern Sweden were Christian. Let's not forget that by the year 1000, like, there were, like, Denmark and Norway were effectively Christianized. Like, this is my two cents. This is a hill I'm going to die on. Christianity in Scandinavia in the Viking Age, not a big thing. No one cared that much.
Probably.
Yeah, that's my hill. And if I get hate mail, so be it.
No, I don't think. I don't think you're far off. I think, because in some cases there are examples of, like, a forced conversion. So I think then maybe those people cared, because that could probably sucked. But also there are cases where it was very, I guess, profitable to convert. It was very, you know, you could gain. There was a lot to be gained from converting, whether it was protection, land.
826. Denmark is ruled by the sons of Godfrey. Their uncle is this guy named Harald Clack. So 826 in the Frankish annals, Royal Frankish annals. It says, at the same time, Harald came with his wife and a great number of Danes and was baptized with his companions at St. Albans in Mainz. The emperor presented him with many gifts before he returned home through Frisia, the route through which he was come. He was given the county of Ruskin, so that he might find refuge there with his possession if he were ever in danger. And then he is now Christian. His wife is Christian. His court of Danes is Christian. And he's asking Louis the Pious to help set him back up on the throne in Denmark.
Mm-hmm.
So 826 already, like, I don't buy that, like, Christianity was this big scary hated thing. It was a tool.
Mm-hmm. I guess that it would be a tool to the elite, but maybe to the everyday person, what do they get to gain from it other than maybe being told to convert?
The promise of heaven. In the Roman times, we see that women and slaves converted to Christianity before free men did. It started as kind of a grassroots thing because they're being told that in heaven, everyone is equal. And while life really sucks as a slave now, one day you'll be up in God's embrace.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, there's this idea of conversion queens that we see in Anglo-Saxon England in the sixth and seventh centuries, where the women are bringing Christianity to their husbands and saying, I'm not going to fuck you until you convert. Like, women and slaves, like, don't discount them. They're the ones who bring Christianity into Rome, into Europe. So
mm-hmm.
I think...
Yeah.
So, and again, if these Viking men are out taking slaves, they're taking Christians, and these Christians are coming into the houses and they're telling their mistresses and saying, hey, look, like, yeah, your men are pigs. Like,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, they don't treat you equally, because again, that's a myth. They did not treat women equally in Scandinavia at the time. And they're saying that, look, like, in the hands of God, you are equal. Like, that's pretty seductive to hear.
Oh, of course. Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah. So I think that the average layperson is getting a lot out of Christianity.
Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. You've changed my mind.
Okay.
There we go.
Or I've just hammered you into, into agreeing with me.
No, never. Absolutely not. Okay. So back to the map.
Okay, back to the map.
Is there anything in particular that you learned or thought that jumped out from putting this together? Was there anything that, like, really changed your mind on maybe what was there before?
Yes. The quick answer is yes.
Yes?
I mean, I think I was very seduced by the idea that the Viking Age began with a series of raids. But then with the map, when I turn, so I think when you click into it, different layers are turned off. But if you turn on source references and then you turn off all the archaeological stuff and you, I have this on before me, and you watch the chronology play out, I have a legend for the source material where the conflicts are these red diamonds and acts of diplomacy are these blue squares. And within the continent, within France and Germany, you see a series of blue squares happening, which is why I am very convinced that the Viking Age is political more than it is a series of random acts of violence. And I think it has to do with the centralizing of power in France, in Denmark, in Norway. And then you also see that England, southern England, mostly left to its own devices. And you see a series of raids happening in Ireland specifically, but then it's also likely happening along the northern coast of Scotland as well, which don't have sources for the time. And so I do think that Denmark, the Kingdom of Denmark, was in kind of a political crossfires with Francia, while the western coast of Norway, whatever powers were up there, were trying to set up a trade colonies over in Ireland and Scotland. So I think that's how it went up until the 850s.
Okay. So what would be, because you said diplomacies, what would they be?
Attending meetings at the court of Charlemagne, at the court of his son, Louis the Pious, asking for peace, claiming that they want peace despite minor incursions.
Mm-hmm.
King Godfried in 808, he does have a kerfuffle with Charlemagne where he takes the Baltic Frankish city of Rurik and he redistributes the merchants there to Hedeby. But even in the records, it's not a random act of violence. The Royal Frankish Annals do say that he relocated the merchants of Rurik and he destroyed the Baltic city of Rurik because he knew it would be profitable through taxes for the Kingdom of Denmark. Like, all just kind of like skip over that, but he did it for tax reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So my friend Tom Horn has said that Vikings were just nothing but venture capitalists. And while I have to like add a little caveat that like, no, I don't think that they were actually venture capitalists, but they were very much out for profit in more sophisticated ways than we think.
Yeah. I mean, we people just have this idea of, you know, of the violent savage. That's kind of what I would say the layperson has, maybe somebody who's not interested in this stuff on any deep level. It would just be a savage that goes raping and pillaging, stealing, and that's kind of all they were. Now, obviously, then on a deeper level, you'd say, oh, were the farmers. But I never really looked deep into or heard of, or we've never kind of discussed on this podcast before, of like the diplomacy side of actually sending people to different courts of kings within Europe and being like, yeah, we want peace. Because that shows like such a clear like organization and understanding of the world around you to be like, okay, yeah, we'll do this if you don't do that. And that kind of, and also it shows a kind of a level of maybe not necessarily a pure equality, but some sort of level standing where someone like Charlemagne is going to go, okay, well, let's have peace rather than me just roll on over there and do my thing and just take what's yours. It shows that there has to be some kind of power and again, centralized power, because if it was just kind of all these different little separate, you know, chieftains, then I feel like it would just be, I'm just going to go take it. Why don't I want to listen to somebody asking for peace? I'll just come and take it because it's easy.
I think this is my big spiel, right? This was like my pitch when I pitched this project to my supervisor. Scholars are very quick to say, you can't look at the Vikings in isolation. You can't look at the Vikings in England, which, no offense, guys, but the English are very want to do. Vikings in England. There's so many books called The Vikings in England or The Vikings of England, so on and so forth. Vikings in Britain.
The whole like Viking age is central around England. It's like the attack on Lindisfarne, and it ends with 1066. But that's like the commonly known Viking age is very England centric, isn't it? Of course not.
And so that's the thing. So then you do have like the Vikings in Ireland, and then you have the Vikings in Francia. But so like, and I have in my thesis all these quotes, like I pick out from every single, like my literature review, which is like in my first chapter, I'm using these people who go on to write books that are called The Vikings in England, The Vikings in Ireland, The Vikings in Francia. I'm using quotes where they're saying, of course, we can't just look at the Vikings here. So like I have a whole compilation of quotes of people saying like, no, we can't do this. And then they go on to do it. And so the idea is you can't look at the Vikings in isolation. They were no respecters of borders. And so we cannot use borders to isolate them, to look at what they're doing, to look at what happened during the Great Heathen Army. I think the Great Heathen Army is misnamed. I refer to it in my project as the Channel Army because they are going back and forth between the English Channel so many times it makes your head spin.
Okay.
I've
never even heard of them going across the channel. So therefore hearing they do it multiple times is, but again, that's probably a testament to what the point you're trying to make of that. I only really hear of it from the English side and this idea of this giant army within England.
And this idea of Ivar the Boneless being the same Ivar of Dublin. I'm going to get a lot of hate for this, but I think it's complete bullshit. I think that there is a connection between York and Dublin later in the like 950s onward. But I think prior to about 950, there was no connection between York and Dublin. There's just no evidence for it.
Okay.
And the death dates of Ivar don't match up between the English and the Irish sources. It's just bananas to me. And so also England doesn't have a lot going on until really there's Lindisfarne, and then there's like Jarrow in 796, and then there's like silence until the 830s at the Battle of Carhampton, and then they disappear for a while. And then it's not really hit until the 850s and the 860s with, you know, the Great Heathen Army, if we must. But like I said, I'd like to call it the Channel Army because it's not centered on England at all in any way, shape, or form. And I think that's completely separate from what's going on in Ireland and likely the west coast of Britain as well, what's going on in Lancaster and Wales, and Scotland.
So when you say it's going back and forth across the channel, what do you mean by that?
You can just watch the map for a while.
They're literally just, are they raiding over in France and then they're coming back to England and then going back?
Yeah, they say it in the Frankish annals. They'll say that like, oh, they finally drove the Danes from the Seine and they crossed the channel over to trying to find it.
Because it's...
It's the same. Yeah, Christian Kloiman talks about it with his hierarchies, which is hierarchies being this idea that they're flotillas that can be kind of split up or brought together as like kind of a centralized fleet that can then splinter off and do their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
So like there's some Danes that splinter off and some stay on the Seine and some. Yeah, here, 861. This is in the Annals of Saint Breton. The Danes had lately come back from England and burned Terron. So that's just, it's, you hear, you just, if you read it on the, on my map, there's a little button at the top right that says timeline. And so you can scroll through year by year, and the Frankish Annals, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, and the Irish Annals are all lined up together under the same. There are different columns on the same row. Mm-hmm. So you can read back and forth what's happening as well as watching the timeline and clicking on things.
Yes. Yeah, it is fascinating because I guess I've always learned of the great heathen army as like the single giant army that's come to conquer England, I guess.
But it's just, it's so much more boring.
Or Revenge the Death of Ragnar.
Oh, no, it's so much more boring when you consider it just as that. They were doing so much more interesting things.
Mm-hmm. So I assume that it wouldn't be the whole army that's going back and forth. It would be...
Hierarchies.
Yeah, parts that are going here, there, everywhere. Yeah. And they kind of... Which would make sense because it is a... Wasn't the army like a... 30,000 people or something?
We don't know.
Okay.
We don't know.
Roughly?
Nor, by the way, I have no idea. I'm not going to make an educated guess. I don't know. But what I would also say, is that they were never out to conquer England as a whole. They were never trying to make an empire. Again, that's anachronistic. 1016, Canute the Great did that, but as a Christian king.
Mm-hmm.
So at this time, so in the 850s, by the way, back to politics, in the 850s, the Royal Frankish Annals do tell us the Danes have a civil war. All the royals are killed, and the kingdom collapses. What follows? A huge exodus, and the quote-unquote Great Heathen Army, but also attacks in Francia. So I think that there's a power vacuum, and.
Yeah, okay.
There are these leaders who go to seek out and carve out new kingdoms. So you have East Anglia that gets carved out, right? The Kingdom of East Anglia. You have Northumbria as well that gets taken. But those aren't the same kings. We don't even really know which kings they are, except for Alfred and Guthrum, the Treaty of Guthrum.
Mm-hmm.
But Guthrum doesn't rule over Northumbria. This is not one united kingdom. These are different Danish leaders who are carving out individual territories. And at the same time, they were also carving out territories in Brittany, in Normandy. Normandy was taken long before Rollo was ever named.
Okay. So why do you think we hear about so much in England? Or is it just because I'm English, so I hear more books because it was here, and people in France or in Normandy hear about the Viking raids there? Or is there just more of a focus on England?
I think that the Victorians, the English Victorians, did a really good job of...
They did like the Vikings.
Propagandizing the Vikings.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was saying that's why maybe we hear about them more.
Yes.
Oh, it's fascinating. Yeah, because I guess other than like hearing of, you know, the attack on Paris, I don't think I've ever really thought about Viking raids in France before.
Really?
Spain, definitely, because we did an episode on the attacks in Spain. But yeah, friends have never really thought, like, maybe naively, it was very much, I thought, oh, well, you know, there was the attack on Paris as like a big event. I never
was
really...
Was that because of a certain TV show?
Well, I think I just heard of it, maybe from the TV show as well. But I never really thought of there being like small raids continuously in the same way that there was maybe over here.
There absolutely was. We just have more awareness, I think, of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. And they gave it a catchy name. They referred to it as the Great Heathen Army, right? The Great Army.
Yeah.
The Mickle Hera. Whereas it's the interest, right? Alfred himself used the Great Heathen Army as propaganda to prop up his rule, to give himself a reason why he should, because he wasn't the king of England. He was the king of Wessex, and he wasn't even the rightful king of Wessex. He took the throne from his nephew, who was the rightful king of Wessex. So
I mean, that's pretty much like most kings throughout English history, though.
Exactly, but like he still had to have some legs to stand on, right? So he's creating this narrative contemporary at the time, saying, oh, well, I'm the savior of Wessex. So I'm the savior of Mercia. I'm the savior of, you know, clearly not fucking East Anglia, because that falls to a group of Danes. But, you know, he's saying, oh, I'm a uniter of kingdoms. I'm the great Alfred. Whereas at the same time in Francia, you don't have a single king coming forward saying, I'm uniting Francia. What you're seeing is Viking groups terrorizing already fractured kingdoms, because, you know, there is no system of primogeniture in Francia at the time. The kingdoms were split between the sons. So Charlemagne had this big fucking empire, and then his son Louis the Pious, he ruled the same roughly area, but he did lose some territories. But then that got split between his sons, and then those got split between their sons. So by the time you have this great heathen army, this channel army that's over in France, you're having kings just knocked down one by one, trying to just scrabble to keep whatever land they're already holding.
Mm-hmm.
So in England, you see this kind of unifying force, whereas in Francia, you see a disruptive force.
Okay.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Okay, before we wrap up, is there anything else that really jumps out from the map that you learned that we need to know about?
No, I mean, I think I've pretty much hammered home that I think we have to look at the politics of the period as well. Oh, and can't think of the Vikings as being some burly, uncultured, money-grabbing, anti-Christian fiends. I think that they were smart, opportunistic, yes, but being opportunistic doesn't necessarily mean you're dumb. It can also be strategic in itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. No, it's been fascinating. I've learned a lot. There's a lot of things that maybe I knew that now I'm going to have to rethink. Things that I've completely overlooked, like the raise on France that I probably should have known, but I've just never thought about it. And it's just, sometimes you need these episodes where it's just little common sense things that you should know. But until somebody literally points it out, you go, oh yeah, that makes absolute sense. And there was an earlier one in the episode as well, but I've forgotten what it was. That you said that. I was like, oh yeah, obviously. But I just never kind of made that connection until somebody literally says it.
I mean, like I said, the map that I've created, it's open source. You can click on each individual link. You can watch the timeline. You can see an area that's close to you if you want to visit it. Hopefully one day I'll get postdoctoral funding to build it, to extend it past 920. That's an arbitrary stopping date. It's just really all I could do in the time that I had. But hopefully. I do hope that people use it and they learn and they play with it and they have fun with it, because I don't know, like I came up with some theories just by watching it like a movie play out over and over and over and over and over again, driving myself like slightly crazy, slightly developing conspiracy theories. But, you know, that meme of Charlie from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia with his red strings everywhere. But yeah, I think... I think it's, yeah, I've got nothing.
No, hopefully people will. And it becomes an important tool for people to use. Because then that's the thing, it's you've done your bit now, but then you may have somebody that looks at it that specializes in a different area, but then can use that with their knowledge. And then that's how you start to come together. Because when I first started this podcast, I naively thought that there was just like some big centralized data for all stuff that scholars do, and they just pile it into this one middle pot, and they all have access to it. And you all just talk to each other. That's what I thought existed. I was like, of course, that makes perfect sense, and it's all like perfectly organized and categorized, and you all just kind of can pull from it and do what you want to do. And then Mateus was like, no, that's not a fucking thing. Nobody helps each other out. Nobody talks to each other.
That's what I have here. Like my contact information is like on the map. There's a big blue button that says contact. I'm not going to hand out my databases at the moment just because I haven't defended and I need some leeway to get funding eventually. But like, the map is there. The information is there. If you guys want to talk to me about it, I am here. Shoot me an email. I don't want to gatekeep. I want people to follow their interests. I want people to learn. I want people to be curious and interact and not fall down into alt-right rabbit holes. So
wonderful. Okay. Well, let's wrap this up. So if you enjoy the show, please leave us a 5-star rating and a positive review wherever you get your podcast. And also, if you want a bonus episode every week, we do a Q&A with the guests after the main show where you can ask your questions either in real time by watching or submit them before. And you get them over on our Patreon. It's patreon.com/NordicMythologyPodcast. And that starts from £3 a month. So that's just 10p a day. And you also get bonus episodes with Jonas Lorentzen where we read through the saga literature and Jonas puts on a bunch of different voices. It's a lot of fun. It's just me and him hanging out and we have a good laugh doing those. And there's our Discord channel. There's a ton of stuff on there. Tonight, where can people follow you? I don't know if you want them to follow you.
I have no social media. So
okay. So we're just going to put the...
The website, I do have a personal website. It's where you can find there's a link to mapping the Viking Age world. So it is my first and last name. It's www.tanayajurgensen.com. You're never going to be able to spell that. So do check the notes.
Yeah. And the episode title, it'll be on there. People can find it. This has been a lot of fun. It's just a very easy conversation as well, which is because sometimes scholars aren't the easiest to have a back and forth.
I've spent so many years bartending to support myself as an academic, so I've been forced to learn how to communicate with people.
Well, there you go. I guess that's a good side to having to have a second job, which you shouldn't have to have.
And amen.
Rocco's decided to start barking as well. So please follow the podcast on all the channels. It's just @NordicMythologyPodcast. And yeah, we're going to jump over and do a quick Q&A.